Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 503rd episode of the Hollywood Reporter's Awards Chatter Podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is, at just 41, one of the top TV producers in show business. He first made his name in America at CBS's The Late Late Show with James Corden, where, at just 33, he became the youngest EP of an American late-night show ever. Through Full Well 73, the company that he founded and runs with Leo Pearlman, Benjamin Turner, and Gabe Turner, as well as Corden, which Variety has described as the go-to production house for A-list talent in unscripted event programming, he has since gone on to produce the Grammys and the Tonys, concert specials starring the likes of Adele, Harry Styles, and Bruno Mars, Max's Friends Reunion, and even Hulu's The Kardashians. He has to his name 33 Emmy nominations, including 8 in 2019 alone, a record for most nominations for an individual in a single year. 12 of those 33 Emmy nominations have resulted in statuettes, and he heads into this year's Emmys with an opportunity to pick up 2 more. Best Variety Special Live for Disney Plus's Elton John Live, Farewell from Dodger Stadium, and Best Short-Form Comedy, Drama, or Variety Series for Apple TV Plus's Carpool Karaoke, The Series. A man described by Forbes as one of the most successful producers in TV, by the Times of London as one of the most powerful people in television, and by Business Insider as one of the most influential TV producers on the planet, Ben Winston. Over the course of our conversation, Winston reflected on how he first crossed paths with Corden, and what his life and work in the UK was like prior to Corden asking him to join him in moving to America to launch The Late Late Show, how Carpool Karaoke came together and why it took off to the extent that it did, how he began moving into live TV production and why he feels that producing the Grammys is the toughest job in showbiz, what he would do to fix the Oscars, the complexities of filming Elton John's final American performance in front of 50,000 people at Dodger Stadium, plus much more. And so without further ado, let's go to that conversation. Ben, thanks so much for coming in and doing this. Great to have you. And on this one, we always begin truly at the beginning. Can you just share for our listeners, where were you born and raised and what did your folks do for a living?
Well, firstly, I'd like to apologize to your listeners who are used to listening to megastars. And now this week, they're like, who? What? Let's skip it.
I am thrilled you're here.
Yeah, I was born in Northwest London, born into an Orthodox Jewish family. My mother was a director of a charitable trust as well as working in education throughout her life. My father is a guy called Robert Winston, who is considered one of the pioneers and inventors of IVF, test tube babies. So I grew up in a house with two incredible parents, loving, supporting, but also geniuses in a way. My brother followed in my dad's footsteps going into the medical world as a neurologist, neuroscientist, and my sister and I went into television. She makes very brilliant, serious documentaries, and I make silly things. And yeah, that's who we are.
I know that you have said that, like many of our Jewish parents, yours might have preferred you be a doctor or a lawyer. But from an early age, it sounds like there was a gravitation towards media, artistic things, right? I heard a lot of editing initially. Was that – were you doing a lot of –
Yeah. I think the main thing I'd say about my parents is that they always wanted me to be happy. And they wanted me to do what I wanted to do. I said that recently about what you just said about, oh, my parents might have preferred me being a lawyer. And my dad heard that and he went, that's not true. We never minded what you did. And that's true. They were really supportive of everything I did, as long as we acted and behaved in the right way. They never really cared about the career. I always knew what I wanted to do. I was one of those like geeky kids who would like watch Sesame Street, and instead of just enjoying it and learning my alphabet, I'd be like, well, how does Big Bird work? How could they move that hand and his eyes? And you know, that was sort of me. I was always wanting to work in this industry. And I would spend every summer, every after school. I remember I got injured at school. I couldn't play football. And so rather than, you know, sitting out and doing what they would get other kids to do, I begged them to let me go and work at the local radio station. And, you know, I always knew that I wanted to work in television and radio. And so spent every summer I possibly could doing that. And actually learned a huge amount from doing that. And I still think some of the things I did back then in the most random jobs, random studios. I actually think about running some of my sort of bigger shows. I still reflect on that today.
Well, I know you, when you went off to University of Leeds, there's, you know, you're studying broadcasting, but on your breaks, I guess, or at some point, speaking of valuable things that came out of just dabbling in short-term projects, how did you meet one James Corden?
Yeah, well, it was a really crazy thing. I was, you know, it's really interesting, those sliding doors moments that change your life forever. I like I said, I was always doing work experience. I was always doing sort of work when I could, even if it meant, you know, not doing the fun stuff like sport or whatever at school. And then I finished school and I got a place at University of Leeds, and I decided to take a gap year because I wanted to go and work in the industry or do something or earn some money or just do something different. And I sort of got two job offers, and I never forget it. One job offer was a paid job working for the biggest soccer agent in the UK at that time. And he looked after all my heroes. You won't understand who those people are because you're Americans.
Right, true.
But for those who would know, we're talking about Dennis Bergkamp, Thierry Henry, Ian Wright. For those that wouldn't know, it's the equivalent of Tom Brady in the UK. And it was a paid job working with my heroes as an agent's assistant. And then I got this other random job that was unpaid, and it was working in a town called Bristol, which was 4 hours outside of London. And it was unpaid. It was on a show that no one had heard of because it hadn't come out yet. And I remember one Friday night, my sister said to me, so what are you going to do? Are you going to work for the football agent, or are you going to go and work on that new show on Channel 4 in the UK? And she looks at me and goes, I know what you're doing. You're going to go and work for the football agent. I said, why'd you say that? She goes, oh, because, you know, you'll hang around with footballers and you get paid and, you know, you're not serious about it. If you were serious about it, you'd do the job in Bristol in the middle of nowhere on the TV show. Because if that's what you want to do, then that's what you've got to do. You know, she was my older sister mm-hmm. who already worked in television. Mm-hmm. And the truth of it is, I was going to work for the football agent because mm-hmm. I really loved Thierry Henry, the footballer. But because at that moment, at that Friday night dinner, I didn't want to lose an argument with my sister and I didn't want to be embarrassed in front of her, I said, no, actually, I'm going to go and work unpaid in Bristol. And the next week I did just that. I moved out to Bristol. I slept on a lovely lady's floor who put me up for a while. And I did unpaid work experience for 3 weeks on this show. And on the first day on set, I met two people who had a big influence on me. One was Andrew Lincoln, who you guys would know as Rick Grimes from The Walking Dead, who was the lead in that show.
This is Teachers, right?
The show. Yeah, the show was Teachers. And he's always been a real sort of mentor and guide to me and great friend and great sounding board. And the other guy was a guy who single-handedly changed my life, and that was James Corden. He had a very small part in that show. He, you know, had a few scenes. And I was the PA who got people coffee. And we always say we recognized ambition in each other, but we became firm friends. And it was that meeting, you know, on that show that led to a partnership that's still going today, 23 years later.
That's amazing.
And yeah, it really changed our lives. I ended up staying on that show for 6 months. It became one of the biggest shows on British television, but I wasn't to know that at the time. And I also worked my way up through it. I started as the unpaid runner, then I became the paid runner. When I say runner, I mean PA, sure. It's what we call it in the UK. Then I became one of the assistant directors, and then I started directing all the behind-the-scenes documentaries. So not only did I meet great people through it, but I also met some individuals who I'm still as close to as anyone today.
Totally. Now, today you are, I think, most widely known as a producer.
For sure.
But at the beginning, I think it was directing, right? As you say, a little bit of that, but also, I think, some commercials.
Yeah.
So basically, what was the – set the scene of how we end up, I think, in 2005 with Full Well 73, and what was the – intention of this at that time?
Full Well 73 is me and three of my closest mates. It's now James Corden is now a fifth partner, mm-hmm. but back then it was just the four of us. And it's Gabe and Ben Turner, who are brothers. Their mum and my mum were best mates.
Okay.
So we grew up in a stroller together and we knew each other from birth. And Leo, our fourth partner, is their first cousin. So it is as incestuous as it could possibly be. And I was just out of college. I was just out of university, finished at Leeds. And we had this idea for a TV show called Footballing. And footballing was almost like Jackass with sport. We found these football tricksters, soccer tricksters, who were unbelievable with a ball. And we came up with this, and it was very much of the time of Jackass was exploding, and it was very like stick it to the man. It was like School of Rock. It was like that sort of attitude. And we've made this like 10-minute little taster tape on home video cameras of them going into the supermarket, doing kick-ups, like ball juggling with grapefruits and pinging grapes into each other's mouths with their feet. And it was like all set to like Prodigy music. And it was like, it was exciting. And we took it to MTV. And MTV went back and forwards with us for 6 months. They loved it. And it was MTV UK. And after 6 months, they said, great news. We've got a meeting with the president of MTV in LA. We're going to fly out there and we're going to pitch your show. And we'll let you know within a few weeks. And we had set up Full Well 73 simply to umbrella this show, footballing. And we were so excited. And we were working out of Leo's spare room in his flat that stunk and was horrible and it was tiny and we, you know, it's just not, but we were kids making shows. And I'll never forget, they came back and they said, good news and bad news. Good news is we are going to make this show, sort of. Bad news is you guys aren't going to make it. We're doing it in-house. MTV Studios is going to make it. We're changing the name to Barry 019 and we're making it not just soccer, it's going to be all sorts of sports, golf and American football and all this. Essentially, you know, I don't know if I can still get sued for this 23 years later saying it, but they stole our show.
Wow.
And it was a brutal time for us because we were these young, excited kids who'd wanted our whole lives to work in TV. And then before we knew it, we had been sort of had this show, we'd been chewed up and spat out.
Yeah.
And it was a really difficult time. And we considered, you know, what do we do? You know, legal things and whatever. But we were four kids with no experience in TV. We had never had a job in television. We weren't like moneyed kids who had like, you know what I mean? We can't take on MTV. And Barry 019 came out. It did two seasons. It was fine. It wasn't as good as if we had made it. But it was a really dark time. And it was one of those moments where we were like, do we even want to do this? And the career that I'd wanted my whole life, I suddenly was doubting whether it was worth it. And then we had this idea for a movie. We had this idea for a documentary. And I won't go into it because it's a long and boring story. But essentially, we used those same football soccer tricksters. And we made a film about them traveling across the world trying to meet their hero, Diego Maradona, who was one of the greatest footballers of all time. And they had no money for food, accommodation or travel. They just hustled and busked and street performed their way across the world, hitchhiking, and we had no money, they had no money. We traveled across the world, had 100 hours of footage, came back to Leo's apartment, edited it, made it, and we sold it to Lionsgate, and it became the biggest release ever of a UK documentary.
This is Hands of the Gods.
This is In the Hands of the Gods, and it came out eventually in 2007, and before you knew it, we had a production company. And then everyone was loved that film and was like, well, what are you four doing next?
Right,
and we're
right.
Like, we don't know. We just spent 2 years making a film.
Right.
A documentary film. And so that was sort of the birth of Full Well, really. And of course it's gone through many permutations and changes over the years, but that's how it started for us. Truthfully, it started the success of Full Well and where we are today all started because MTV stole our show.
Unbelievable.
And it's really interesting because I also wonder now if they hadn't stolen that show and we'd made it, would it have been great? I don't know. It would have been okay. But Full Well might have just fizzled out after that.
It's another one of those moments.
One of those moments. Sometimes what happens is for the best, even though you can't see it at that time.
Well, okay. So I'm going to bring up another of those kind of really interesting moments, I think. James Corden, in his early days in the business, is, I believe, acting on a show that's not significant which show it was, but there's a young kid in the cast, I believe, whose mother says, you know, keep an eye on my kid. So connect the dots from this to how you ended up being the director of the early documentaries of One Direction, their music videos, and I believe having Harry Styles live with you for 2 years. I mean, this again just shows how one little thing can lead to crazy other things.
Well, both those things are correct, but actually neither of them are linked.
Okay.
Yeah. So James was doing a show called Fat Friends, and there happened to be a chaperone who was looking after the young actors on that show. And that happened to be Louis Tomlinson's mother. And so James met Louis Tomlinson, who was in One Direction, before One Direction were formed. That is one story. Yeah. It's actually not linked to, to my story, truthfully. There was no crossover there.
Even it crazier.
It just sort of happened. No, I was my version of that is not as crazy, really. I was making a I directed a film with a boy band that were massive in the UK called JLS. They were sort of like maybe a young English version of Boys to Men. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that, I don't know whether Boys to Men or JLS were like that comparison, but I'll go with it for this podcast because maybe neither of them will listen. And I was making it and it was really good. I was really proud of it. It was a really good film. And their JLS's management had just taken over One Direction while they were in X Factor. And I remember watching X Factor and thinking these kids are really great and, you know, they could be something. And I remember watching it with James, actually, because we were such close friends. Mm-hmm. We would always watch X Factor together on a Sunday night. And I remember James one day said, you know, those boys, they're going to be bigger than Jesus. I really remember him saying that. I don't know why. Anyway, out of the blue, Harry McGee and Richard Griffiths, their management, called me up and said, look, X Factor's coming to an end. We'd love you to meet the boys. We think, you know, there's going to be a lot of interest in them. Maybe you make a documentary on their first year. Maybe you just... I also think they wanted me to meet them because I was sort of an... I wasn't as old as the management or the label, but I wasn't as young as them. I was sort of this like midway level that was closer to their age. And I remember I met them in a hotel in Chelsea and we just hung for a couple of hours, me and the five boys. And they hadn't released their first song yet. And I just chatted to them about how it was going and what they were feeling. And I remember I ordered a mint tea and they thought that was hilarious. like I would order a mint tea because they were that young that they thought ordering a mint tea was like, what? A mint tea? And so we just got on really well. And then I started making the documentary of their first year. And literally we would travel around in one 6-seater van. And it'd be the security guard and their manager in the front with the security guard driving. And I would sit on those 3 seats. It was like a Ford Viana. Right. And it would be the five of them and me. And we traveled all over the country. And I would film it and I was the sound man, the cameraman. I was the whole thing.
Right.
And it was really interesting. As they got bigger and bigger and bigger over the next 5-6 years, my career also changed a lot. And so did our company's Fullwell. Because we started, you know, making this small one-off documentary for ITV2. And by the end of it, we were making the This Is Us for Sony Pictures.
And can I just note, just really quickly, because I don't want to – I think people – to give context of how much things blew up. 5 years after In the Hands of the Gods, you're with – Queen Elizabeth II doing On Her Majesty's Service, right? That's 2012. You've done in that period also a bunch of things with James where I think the first time you guys are working together, right, where you're initially directing, I think the first thing was something to do with the World Cup maybe, 2010?
Yeah, we did like the first time we actually worked together, I was directing him on a sketch where he played Smithy and Gavin and Stacey.
Okay.
But that was the first time we worked together. But yeah, we did a big entertainment show in the UK, which was we would go live after every World Cup soccer game and do like an hour's comedy show. It was actually like a bit like The Late Late Show, really.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like our first foray into that.
2010.
That was 2010, yeah. It was called World Cup Live. That was me and Gabe Turner, and we did that with Susie Aplin and James, and yeah, they were great times. And all through that time, I was also doing, you know, I was directing the One Direction music videos. I was directing their docs. I was, you know, Fullwell became almost like the home. The boys trusted us.
Yeah,
they were very, very loyal, and they were like, we really like these guys, and therefore, if they had anything from a perfume commercial to the screens behind them on their tour, we would make it.
Wow.
And it was a really big. Just like it was, this is a non-creative word to use, but they were a really big client for us.
Yeah,
because we, you know, we had made stuff like In the Hands of the Gods and what have you, and like that World Cup show. But the consistent work from at that time, you know, taking it all the way up to 2016, you know, for 5 years, we were the go-to guys for the biggest band in the world,
yeah.
And I'll always be grateful for their loyalty to us. And we had some amazing times. And, you know, directing those videos, I think about that now, the budgets I used to have to play with on those videos, it really was, I had to become a good director fast because, you know, I was getting the jobs because they, you know, were loyal to me. But then I also knew that, like, everybody from the chairman of Sony to Simon Cowell is looking at these videos going, is this, do we want, yeah, oh, no, he's good. Okay, he gets them to. And actually, me and my partners, we would get the boys to do things that they wouldn't have done otherwise. If you want proof of that, look at the the video for Best Song Ever with Zayn dressed as a secretary. I'm not sure I'd be allowed to do that in 2023. But remember the time that we made that in before you try and cancel us.
Right.
But my point is, there was a trust and a friendship that allowed us to do stuff that others might not have.
Now, what happened in there that made you sort of shift focus from directing to producing? I know that, for instance, you directed a short with James in 2011. James Corden, May I Have Your Attention, Please? The next year, there's another TV project, When Robbie Met James, where you're producing. Also, 2011 through 2014, James began hosting and you began producing the Brit Awards, which I think are a precursor to you later doing the Grammys. Sure. But how do you explain that shift from directing to producing?
Well, firstly, your research is excellent. Look at that. I feel like this is your life. I think when you're running a company, and Full Well 73 is so important to me, and the growth of it is so important to me. It still is today. It's still what gets me up every morning going, like, what great shows can we make? I think when you're a director, you have to be single-minded. You have to be across every single detail, and you have to live and breathe it. And today, as I sit here, I would say there's about 14 shows that I'm overseeing, whether they be in pre-production, whether they be trying to sell them, whether they be in post or in production as we speak. And so if I was to suddenly say, oh, I'm going to go and direct that, that would take me out of everything, because you need to be there for every scout, you need to be there for every costume fitting, you need to be there for every part of the edit. And truthfully, as the business grew, it was just impractical for me to carry on directing. I still do direct the odd thing. I directed the Friends reunion because there's some things that I'm like, nah, I'm not letting anybody else do that. And so there's certain moments where I really enjoy it. But I think for me in my life, I really love juggling things. I love working on different shows in different genres. And so therefore, actually just directing, it just, as I got older, not that older, I mean, I just, like, you know, we're still talking about like when I was 30.
Right.
But like, I just felt like I'd done directing, I'd enjoyed it, but there were bigger things for me to be able to do. And so, yeah, I just gradually stopped directing because of time. And that was really the truth of it. There's not much more to it than that.
This brings us basically to 2014, 2015, when Craig Ferguson announces he's leaving CBS and they have to now find a successor to follow Letterman, soon to be following Colbert, who's going to replace Letterman. Why do you think they even thought about James, who had no profile in the U.S.? I mean, he'd won a Tony, but that's part one. And then part two, can you explain how you wind up then meeting with Les Moonves at a meeting that you've implied he pretty clearly didn't want to be at first?
Oh, for sure he didn't. Well, why did they choose James? That's a question for Nina Tassler and Les Moonves, but I would say it's of great credit to them that they recognize something that other people hadn't necessarily seen. Because for me, and I know I'm biased, but I'm still honest. I don't think there's a better all-round performer in the business than James. I don't need to say that anymore because I'm not doing the Late Late Show. I actually mean it. There isn't anybody that will win a Tony Award for a performance that makes you laugh and cry like he did in One Man, Two Governors. Or you could look at the History Boys or any other of his theatre work. There isn't a guy that could host the Tonys and the Grammys as well as he did, because he just did that so easily. There isn't a late night show host who can sing, dance, be funny, be interesting and interested in people as he's done. And let's not forget, when he decided to write a sitcom, that was Gavin and Stacey, and that was the biggest sitcom in the history of Britain. And when I say that, we did I shouldn't say we, because I had so little involvement. I was so honored to get an executive producer credit, but all I did was like organize it and find the money on that one. But James and Ruth Jones created Gavin and Stacey. We did a Christmas special a couple of Christmases ago, got 18 million viewers. And remember, it's not 18 million American viewers. We're talking about England. We're talking about a country the size of New Jersey.
Nothing gets 18 million viewers anywhere.
Nothing gets 18 million. Like, England can get to the World Cup final and they might not get it. It was the biggest entertainment show in years, and that's James, and that's James and Ruth's brain. And so as a writer, as a performer, both scripted and unscripted, I think he's a genius. I really think he's a genius. And so Nina and Les, who have always recognized great talent, I mean, Leslie's got a history of it, saw him. The story goes that he saw him in One Man, Two Governors, and in the interval, he called his team and he said, I don't know who the hell this guy is, but I want him on my network. And I think that's probably true.
Yeah.
And then obviously that didn't happen for a while, and James was busy with his own stuff. He was doing Into the Woods at the time with Meryl Streep. And so it didn't really work out. But eventually he agrees to take this show. And then I remember I was making a One Direction special for NBC and I was cutting it in central London, and James came to visit me in the edit, which isn't that unusual, but it was unusual in that he had something to talk to me about. It was a bit more. And he sat me down and he said, I've decided I'm going to host the Late Late Show. And I said to him, I think you're I think you're making one of the biggest mistakes of your life. I think you are someone who loves being able to write a sitcom, act in a movie, host a show, do an award show. Like, you love juggling stuff.
Right.
I think going on a late night show and interviewing people every night will drive you insane. You'll be reading jokes and interviewing people, and I think it's the worst decision you've ever made. And he's like, well... I remember it so clearly. I literally remember where we were sat on Great Portland Street and like what was out the window. It's a really one of those moments where you look, you know, those moments where, and he said, I couldn't disagree with you more. He said, think about it differently. He's like, every single day we could wake up and have a blank piece of paper to create anything we wanted for 1 hour on the number one network in America.
Now because he's
so,
trying to court you
and there's two things I thought about yeah. there. I thought, well, firstly, he's right.
Yeah.
We could create anything
right.
we wanted to, and it doesn't need to be what's gone before.
Right.
And the second thing I noticed was he was saying we.
Yes.
And I was like, whoa, I've just done up my house. What are you talking about? I've literally moved out for 2 months right. to like get the painters in, and there's no way I'm telling my wife I'm going to LA. And he was like, I want you to come with me. And James has always had this belief in me and faith in me. That, you know, I don't know if anyone else has ever had as much faith in me as he had. And I'll always be grateful for that as we go on and do other things, and we're still partners and we always will be. But like, it's a real like safety net in my life that there's been this guy who I rate as the most talented in the world going, you're brilliant. Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter is, let's just, you know, I am, you know, as a North London guy, I'd never made anything apart from a One Direction music video that was anything that had been shown in America. I'd made shows in the UK. I had.
Right.
I'd made decent shows in the UK, and they'd rated well and done well. But suddenly here was James Corden, who was already, everyone was going, who the hell is James Corden? And now James is saying to Leslie Moonves, by the way, you've got to meet Ben Winston because he's got to executive produce this show.
Who, by the way, let's just say, Ben Winston, who is 33, meaning maybe 32 at that point.
Yeah.
But just to give the context of how unusual this would be, the guy who was the executive producer,
Peter LaSalle
of Craig Ferguson, I think was 85 when he left.
He was 83, yeah.
83.
I think he was 83. Or maybe he was 85. You might be right. And he was a legend.
Yep.
He was a guy who had produced Johnny Carson, then Letterman, then Craig Ferguson. And there was James Corden, who already they must have gone, we know he's talented, but like, is this show going to work? Because everyone thought they were going to get Chelsea Handler or maybe Tina Fey, or there was all these names. Joel McHale was spoken about. And there it was this guy saying, I've got to bring my mate along. And it was so, like, if anybody said to me right now, you know, oh, what, if I, you know, brought in a talent to a show and they said, I'm bringing my mate from home. What's he produced in late night? Nothing. What's he produced in America? Nothing. Doesn't matter. You're going to love him. So I flew out to LA and I was really excited about this. And I remember it so clearly. I was very excited just to meet Les Moonves.
Yeah.
And I knew that James had said I was the man for the job and he wouldn't do it without me. He had said that. But yeah. I still knew that, like, James is also, like, a talent and therefore he'll always have demands. And if they are turning around to him and saying, look, we love you, you're great, you've got this show, but you're not having your mate produce it. I don't know if James would have gone, I'm out. He might have done. That's for him to answer. He'd probably say he would have done.
Yeah.
Whether he would have done, I'm not quite sure. And by the way, I would have never let him do that.
Right.
If they had said, Ben, you're not producing this show, there is no way in the world I would ever let my best mate turn down this opportunity that he has now convinced me is a good one.
Right.
Just because I'm not allowed to join him, it would be absurd. So I remember I flew out. I remember I bought myself a jacket. I really remember that because I'd spent more money than I had. And I bought a jacket and I went and got a haircut in London. And I got on a plane. It was very exciting. I was going to LA. I'm off to Hollywood. And I was so excited to meet Les. And I think, and you know, and I was really like, had a, you know, a skip in my step. And I was told to be there, Sunset Tower, 6 o'clock, Sunset Tower, you're meeting Leslie Moonves. And, you know, I've wanted to work in television my whole life. This is the guy that cast Friends.
Yep.
This guy cast ER. This is the guy who made CBS number one network in the world. This is a titan of our industry. And I walk in and I sit down. And that excitement, when this guy looked at me as if to go,
who the fuck am I meeting? What's my next meeting? I'm having to meet the new host at 12:30's best mate. What is this meeting? And Nina was really friendly and lovely. She was there too. And I remember just seeing him. And by the way, I just want to say, he wasn't rude in any way.
Yeah.
Just want to say, this is not a story about Les being disrespectful. He was nothing but respectful. But I suddenly got a reality check. That's all it was. I got a reality check.
Right.
And he looked at me and he went, right, okay, well, I've been told that James wanted us to meet, so how are you? And we small talked for a while, and I was very deflated because in that moment I felt silly. I felt like, oh, I thought I was going to, you know, I'd come from, you know, producing decent shows in the UK and working with One Direction, and suddenly I was like, what am I doing? Of course they don't want me to do this show. I'm James's mate. I went in thinking I was about to produce like a big show, and I sat there and I was like, oh, I'm James Corden's friend. This is crazy. But then something also happened to me in that moment where I suddenly, all nerves went out of my body because I knew I wasn't getting the show. I knew I'd been naive. I knew I'd been silly. I knew I wasn't, you know, good enough for it. And so in some ways, like, I didn't care anymore. And actually, sometimes that's the best place you can be. And without giving a F, which I won't say on your podcast,
you're welcome.
Delicate ears. And I sort of just shot from the hip.
Yeah.
And I said, you know what? You've got the greatest guy ever making a late night show for you in James Corden. And this is what I would do. And I launched into like a monologue about, you know, the digital age, about a 360 stage, about people coming through the guests coming through the audience. I talked about there's no point having a talk show after a talk show, stuff that James and I had been talking about for the last few months. I talked about the fact that James was a man of the people, and therefore, rather than having like all other late night sets, us and them, let's have everybody out together so it feels like a party. Let's put the cameras in the middle of the set, behind a part of the audience, so that the audience at home feels part of this crew, very like less sort of separation. We talked about having to succeed in the digital world. I said to them, with James, you have someone who can sing, who can dance, who can talk, who can tell jokes. Like, we could make the most original entertainment show. And I really went for it. And as I was going for it, I could see him lifting and sort of going, that I just sort of felt like, oh, this is going well, you know. And by him smiling at me, I suddenly got more and more encouraged, and I got more sort of articulate about it, and I was coming up with stuff, and I was like this. And there was this silence when I finished, and I literally remember going, that's what I would do with this show.
Yeah.
Sort of put down my expensive glass of sparkling water at the Sunset Tower. And he looked at me and he said, well, I knew I had the right man for the show in James, but I didn't really know what the show was till now. Thanks very much.
Wow.
And at that moment, Julie Chen arrived and he shook my hand, and I thought I was staying for dinner, but it was clear I wasn't. And the 6:30 had come and Julie had arrived, and that was my cue, and I sensed it was my cue, and I thanked them both very much, and I left. And I sort of walked up Sunset Boulevard, and so, like, it was, you know, almost sort of back to this hotel that I was staying in. And I was sort of a bit like, that was such a surreal experience. And I genuinely have no idea if I'm doing this show or not. And I knew that James had said he has to do the show with me.
But, yeah,
you know, I'm also of the real world, right, going, CBS are paying the money. Right. And I flew home the next day and I got a call from Joel Lubin at CAA. And he said, they loved you. They want you to EP it. They want Full Well 73 to make it. They've made you an offer of X. And I said, that's incredible. And I agreed to do it for 9 months. And I said, I'd do 3 months set up the show, 6 months running the show. Had to find someone to run it with me because I was going back to the UK. I had no intention of staying more than the setup because I had a production company in the UK that I was running with Gay, Ben and Leo. We found Rob Crabb, who became my partner in crime on The Late Late Show. And I said I'd stay for 9 months. And here we are talking, right? Later. It's been 9 years. I have two American children.
Right.
And so I guess I stayed.
Well, and I think part of that is because you guys came out of the gate so impressively. I mean, just quoting back to you something that – or some stats that I think you had shared once. But Roll Call, the first one was on night one. First Carpool Karaoke was night two. First Crosswalk the Musical was night three. Just the work that goes into making any one of those things happen is tremendous. And here we are, you know, people were really kind of getting that on a regular basis. Also, the thing that I know you said you brought up at that first meeting with Moonves, but that really became the one of the defining characteristics of The Late Late Show was that there was this almost, I think, maybe shaping of content to cater not just to people who are trying to stay awake at 12:30, but who are going to watch it on YouTube. And I wonder if you can talk about how you regarded ratings versus social media viewership.
Yeah, I mean, I've always felt that at 12:30 in this day and age, the people who are watching the show are just the people who can stay awake. And James always used to make me laugh, and he said, look, no one is a bigger James Corden fan than me. I think I'm fantastic. And even I can't stay awake.
Right.
So how's anyone else gonna? And I think that, you know, at 12:35 in this day and age, and I'm not talking about days gone by, but I'm talking about the current era we live in, ultimately we would do well on nights that Colbert bothered with parts 5 and 6, and we would do badly on nights when they didn't.
Right.
And I don't mean that facetiously. No. I mean that with love. You can't always do 6 banging parts every night. Some nights you do have a musician who shit.
Right.
You know, you just do. Or you taper off with a third guest that's, you know, talking about a book that no one's read, right, and people fall asleep. And we would see that in our numbers. And then other nights he'd have Barack Obama on, and we would get, and the network would go, congratulations on your ratings last night. And we'd be like, that's bullshit.
Right.
We do not take that congratulations. Right. We are getting congratulated because Barack Obama went on for 45 minutes. You know, we're very, very realistic. We're very British.
Right.
We're very British.
Right.
But meanwhile, I could wake up every morning and I could see on YouTube that there would be – Carpool Karaoke is a great example. That was on show number 2. We had no idea the power of it. And then within 24 hours, we had 14 million hits. Now, remember, James is unknown and he's got 14 million hits in 24 hours. Suddenly, we are like – oh, we've got something on our hands here. And we started, I would say, our first 2 or 3 years, we would program our show by what we would see on our YouTube numbers. If something failed on YouTube, we wouldn't do it again.
Mm-hmm.
If something was rating high, we would push it. We could feel it, we could see it, we could tell the drop off. And it became the way to program our show. And the mentality that we always had on our program was, we do not make a show for 12:30. We launch a show at 12:30.
Right.
And come watch us whenever you want. And there was a time when we were, without question, the biggest show internationally. James's show was being watched in more countries than any of the other late night shows. And that was really fascinating. And it was because we were making stuff that was really speaking to people wherever they were, and whatever time it was. And so, you know, that was it changed everything for us both. And people, we went from begging people to come on the show to it becoming the place where if Tom Cruise wants to do something, really, he's only doing it on our show.
Yeah.
I'm not saying he hasn't done other stuff,
right,
on other shows, but like, we became the home for Harry and for Tom and for many people, really.
Michelle Adele. Obama.
Yeah, I mean, it was a place where people really wanted to come and have fun. And within a year and a half, we're at the White House driving around in a car with Michelle Obama, and we're at the Emmys, and we're like going, how has this happened?
Now, let me ask you, because Carpool Karaoke is a thread that goes from the beginning of the show through you're going to go to the Emmys whenever they finally happen this year as a nominee for Carpool Karaoke, the special again.
The series, excuse me.
Yeah,
the Apple series.
The series, right. But the point is that that in particular,
yeah,
is always going to be synonymous with The Late Late Show,
yeah,
and you and Corden. Can you just share, because it actually emerged from something that you guys had done before, right? Which I'd love for you to describe, but just also how that took on a life of its own.
Mm, it really did. Well, I'd mentioned earlier that I'd done some sketches with James playing a character called Smithy that came from Gavin and Stacey, that successful UK sitcom. And we did a sketch with George Michael when he'd come out of jail, and James as Smithy went to pick him up. And originally we'd pitched that we'd pick him up from jail, and then I think George felt maybe that was going slightly too far. So we just picked him up, and James was on his way to a meeting at the charity Comic Relief, and he didn't want George to come with him because, you know, he said, George, you can't come into Comic Relief. You know, it was a really self-deprecating, right, sketch from George. And they would sing, they sung, and James put on some Wham music, and they sung I'm Your Man and a couple of other songs, but they were both in character. George was playing a character, James was playing a character. And then the sketch was another 15 minutes. It featured Justin Bieber. It featured Paul McCartney. It actually featured JLS, that band that I spoke
about. Yeah.
It featured my father. It featured Gordon Brown, the Prime Minister at the time.
Right.
If you ever want to watch that, Smithy Saves Red Nose Day, that's what you should watch. Yeah. And that's where you can see the sort of the start of comic of Carpool. But what was really funny about that is we'd done this unbelievable like 15-minute opus of a sketch, which was very Jimmy Kimmel's Handsome Men's Club. You know, and I've said that openly at the time. Yeah. We had been inspired by that. So don't, you know, don't go, oh, it's a bit like, no. We know that. We saw it. We loved it. We made our own version. Welcome to Late Night. Right. And people just went nuts for the singing in a car. And so when we had moved out to LA, we were sat in our conference room every day for those 3 months that we had to launch our show. We moved out on January the 1st, 2015, and we went live on March the 23rd. That was 2.5 months to create a show from nothing with no staff. It was bonkers. And we just spent every hour of every day thinking of ideas. And we spoke about the fact that George Michael thing had done well. I had happened to watch wasn't sleeping well at the time, I remember, because I was so nervous about the show. So I would fall asleep to Curb Your Enthusiasm. And there was an episode where he picked up a hooker and they drove in the carpool lane.
To Dodger Stadium,
because he wanted to beat the traffic to the baseball. Right. And I remember thinking, oh, carpool lane, we don't have that in the UK. So that means if I pick somebody up, I'm allowed to just like beat the traffic. I just remember it like dawning on me that was a funny thing. And so we were talking the next day and we were saying, no one wants to come on our show. No one's trusting enough. They thought of British people like Piers Morgan and Simon Cowell, who are cynical and out to get us. And they're all the publicists, and I don't blame them. Yeah. They were all like, look, we're not saying we won't come on your show. We're just going to wait and see what it's like first. And at the time, I thought this was the biggest injustice ever. Right. Now I totally get it. And so we were like, well, how do we go to them? How do we make it easy? Maybe we drive to junkets. Maybe, you know, it's like, yeah, but then it shows we can't get them in the studio. And so then we had this idea, well, maybe we go pick them up, pick up the artist. We do what we did with George Michael. We drive around, we interview them, we play their tracks, they sing along. And then I think I said, and then they can go in the carpool lane because it can help get James to work. He'll almost be like, we could start the show. We could say, James, loads of traffic in LA. So he needed someone to get to work. We'll pick him up in the carpool lane. And James went, we'll call it carpool karaoke. And I remember he literally threw his pen down. He went, right, that's it. And he went home for the day because we'd like cracked it. But we could never have expected it to be what it was. We could never have expected it to take on a world of its own. But the fact of the matter is the real reason why it started going big was because it was Howard Stern level of interviews, because people were so honest, because there were no makeup artists, there was no publicists. It was just him and Lady Gaga sat in a car with them forgetting the cameras had gone. You know, there weren't cameramen, right? So you forget there's a load of GoPros after 5 minutes. So suddenly, before you know it, you're telling really honest stories or, you know, like doing impersonations or like... It's so disarming, and James is so friendly and warms people so much that J-Lo is telling stories about texting Leo DiCaprio and going on dates with him, and you're like, what? Yeah. And we're finding out all these exclusives. The ratings would go through the roof.
Yeah.
We started getting hundreds of millions of views. But the fundamental thing that changed it was people sold albums.
Yeah.
You know, I remember I saw Lady Gaga at the Friends reunion, and she said, I got a number one album because of Carpool Karaoke. She was like, we were trending at number three that week. Carpool went out and I shot in at number one. I got my number one album. You know, Stevie Wonder's Greatest Hits album wasn't even in the charts, and it went to number one in the charts that week that he did Carpool with us. And he wasn't even promoting it. It was just like, you know, I remember Adele, All I Ask, which is my favorite Adele song. It's just an amazing song. And we loved it. It wasn't a famous Adele song. It was sitting 95 in the charts because it wasn't a single. It was just an album track. But me and James loved it. They sing it, and it went to number three in the charts that week. And suddenly every artist was like, wow, this is the place to sell our music.
Right.
We were doing bigger numbers than SNL, and we were selling more albums than them or the Grammys. And so sitting in a car driving around LA suddenly became the way to sell your album, and people were queuing up to do it.
Now, where were you during these – when they're in the car – are you watching sort of a live feed?
So actually, there's a video on my Instagram of our last one we ever did with Adele, because people always ask me that. So I filmed what we're doing before it.
Yeah.
You can see that on Instagram. It's really lovely. So I'm in a follow car, and we invented this technology. We didn't. Seamount, the company, did. Where I have a live gallery. I can see. It's literally like I'm in a control room.
Yeah.
I have every single camera because there's... there'll be 11 cameras as well as the side cameras like filming outside. Because, of course, if they stop and someone comes to the window, we want that shot too.
Right.
So there's a lot of cameras in that car. So we'll have audio that's piped through the car. And it will be me, which I have comms to James, so I can speak to James.
Okay.
Next to me is Lauren Greenberg, our head writer. Behind me is Tom Jarvis, the editor. And then we have a C-mount guy, you know, who's our technical guy, Jason, who in case anything goes wrong. And we just drive around behind the car. And he has a follow car that he follows because I don't want him to ever think about the route. I don't want him to get lost. And also he needs to drive away from the sun so that there's no shadows.
Right.
So we have a route mapped out depending on where the sun is. I should say Glenn Clements, the director, is also in the car. And we're following him around, watching it, making edit notes as we go. And I'll be calling it going, Tom, I didn't love that song and let's cut that. So I'll be like literally giving edit notes as we drive. And we loved it.
James has learned the lyrics of every song.
I mean, James learned. I mean, that is bizarre. The fact that this guy can learn the lyrics to like Bad Bunny at the same time as knowing every Meghan Trainor lyric, it is bonkers.
Totally.
It's bonkers. But I mean, I guess that helps being an actor because he learns lines fast.
Yeah.
But I remember, if you sit in traffic on the way home or on the way to work with James and I can see him in my rear view mirror and he just looks like a mad person, like rapping along to lyrics. And like, you know, it's like he's suddenly singing Pink's new album, but it's like, you know, he learns everything as he drives. It changed our lives, Carpool. It really did. And then we sold that series to Apple. And now it's been in 6 seasons in Apple and it's not James in that show. Still discovering it. You know, this season we had, you know, Alan Cummings with Brian Cox. We had Cara Delevingne with her hero Alanis Morissette. We had Sandra Oh with Duran Duran. It's really fun combinations and it's a really great show I'm very proud of.
If there's one thing I loved more than even the Carpool Karaoke's that you guys did, it was when Corden met McCartney live from Liverpool. It's so rare that I would, you know.
I directed that.
I know you did.
You know what I was saying to you about I only do the things I want to do now?
That's
Friends
a good
reunion,
one.
Friends reunion, sure, I'll do that. McCartney, yep, I'll do that. It's very selfish.
I DM'd you and or James after that to say, like, this is the best thing I've ever seen.
Oh,
it was
man,
so amazing. And that was, you know, just show who else could do that, you know, with him. So
James Corden's
and you just put together beautifully. But I guess before we come to the sort of post Corden amazing things you've been doing, just one thing that it's a tough question, but you know, there are a lot of us. Like I think James is unbelievable in large part because of the collaboration that he has with you. At some point, it feels like, and I don't know if it's just because people get tired of rooting for the underdog or whatever, but it feels like a certain segment of people, it became suddenly not cool to be supportive of James it was cool to be mean about James or whatever. Did you guys feel that? And what the hell do you attribute that to?
I think there's the real world and then there's the Twitter world.
Yeah.
Walk down a street with James for a minute and tell me that people don't love him.
Right.
Because there's a guy who everybody wants to come up to and say, when's the new Gavin and Stacey? They want to say, I cried my eyes out watching you sing with Adele. They want to tell him that the Paul McCartney documentary is the best thing they've ever seen. They want to tell him that they'd never had a night in the theatre like they did at One Man, Two Governors. They tell him that their League of Their Own on Sky is their favourite show. It could go on and on and on and on. And I think the Twitter sphere is a tricky old place. And I think that it's really important that all of us stop looking down in our phones and start looking up at the real world. And then you'll find a lot more joy and love than you will elsewhere.
Most of what we have talked about up to this point is pre-recorded material. Like you guys shoot, what time would you shoot?
5.
5. And then it goes out at 12:30 or a lot of the stuff we're talking about. Live television, again, I'm not saying there weren't things before. Like I think the British version of the Grammys and things, I'm sure were live. But I think it starts with award shows in a big way, right? Because a year into the Late Late Show, you do the Tonys for the first time in 2016 and then would do that again in 2019 on CBS with James hosting, you producing, then the Grammys started in 2017, 18, 19, 20, 21, the year of the, you know, only nominees, Grammys because of the pandemic, 22, 23, not yet the Oscars, but I'm going to ask you about that in a moment. But just what are the, if you could just take us into, you have said that the Grammys in particular are maybe the most challenging undertaking of any that you've been a part of. Why is that?
Well, let me just, because you've read off a load of credit, let me just explain the difference with some of those,
sure.
And then I'll come to why I don't think maybe it's the hardest show. I think it is the hardest show.
Okay.
And I'll state my case, my lord.
Please.
When I did the Tonys and I did the Grammys, when James hosted both of those, I definitely was exec producer of it, of course, but I take no credit for those in a way, because although I was very involved in James's opening or James's bits, it was very much Ken Ehrlich's Grammys and it was very much Glenn and Ricky's Tonys. So people often credit me with that, and I'm grateful for it because I definitely was producing James, but I wasn't producing the show. And it's important that I say that, because I know now, because I do the whole thing with Raj, that I know, like, I don't want to take credit for stuff I wasn't. So what happened when James left the Grammys and stopped doing it, the Recording Academy came to me and said, Ken Ehrlich was thinking of stepping down from the Grammys. He'd done it 40 years, done it great. And would I be interested in taking over? And I was really nervous about doing that. And I said, I sort of went back, and when Alicia Keys hosted it, I sort of number two'd for Ken. So I did that job where I was like, I wasn't producing James anymore because he wasn't hosting it. Alicia was. But I sort of got the lay of the land. I learned what I liked and also what I didn't like. And I mean that in all ways about how I wanted to make the show and make it my own. And I sort of did that also to find out if I really wanted to do it. And it made me very nervous. But I decided that I felt like I could do something really great with it. And I love music and I love live telly. And so I was like, this is a real honor to do it. So I decided to take the job and take the plunge. And I've done three. So although you've named me being EP for many, I've only really been the showrunner and like the boss of it.
With your first one being?
COVID. And Raj Kapoor and Jesse Collins have done them with me. So I always want to give credit to those who we do it with. So that first one was crazy for me, because I would lose. I don't usually get nervous. I lost so much sleep over that show. Here's the reason why I think the Grammys is the toughest show in the biz.
I'm ready.
And I'm very aware that this is an odd thing to say considering I make it, but I'm just talking about it logistically. So firstly, it's live. And there's actually not that much stuff that's live these days.
Right.
So I'm not saying it's more difficult than producing Game of Thrones. It's totally different. I'm not saying that. I'm talking about in this genre.
Right, right.
If you're going to go live, then what are you? The news is live. Okay, sports live. There's award shows that are live. There's the odd sitcom that's live for an hour if Norman Lear does it with Jimmy. The Grammys is 3.5 hours. Firstly, everybody has an opinion and everybody's trying to hate your show. That's the first thing. Second of all, it is the biggest show in music. It is music's biggest night. That's not just a slogan. It truly is. And you can see that by the fact that Find Me Another Show last year that had in the audience Adele, Beyonce, Jay-Z, Taylor Swift, Harry Styles, Bad Bunny. Then, you know, that's just those people. Then you've got the people presenting, from J-Lo to The Rock.
Madonna.
It's bonkers. That room is bonkers.
Yeah.
And so therefore there is pressure in that. It's also 3.5 hours, which is a lot longer than the other music award shows, which means there's more performances. You have 21 music performances on average in that show. Every single one of those needs to be amazing, because everybody thinks they have the prettiest wife at home. Everybody thinks they're Beyonce, Adele, Harry.
Right.
If you're on the Grammys, you're massive, and therefore you're going to treat it like you're massive. And it's also their biggest night.
Right.
They're not going, I'm going to save my big stuff for the AMAs.
Right.
They're going, this is my night. I'm going hell for leather. I'm going fireworks and dancers. And everybody wants to do it. You get the keys to that room on Thursday. You then have to rehearse 21 performances that you've been building for only 8 weeks. Because unlike the other award shows that can say, hey, Dolly Parton, with a year to go, do you fancy being an honoree next year? Sure, I'd love to. Oh, let's plan for a year. We get the nominations 8 weeks before, and we don't get them a minute earlier, and you can't plan for a thing. And even if you could plan for a thing, no one would tempt fate by saying, I'll talk to you early. No one wants to take your call until they know they've got a nomination. And you get a nomination end of November, and you do the show end of January. Also within that M week, there's something called Christmas, Thanksgiving, and New Year's. So essentially, you've actually got about 5 weeks to put on the biggest show on TV. Then on top of that, you're dealing with backstage. Every artist comes with a band, maybe an orchestra, maybe 10 dancers, maybe 100 dancers. Maybe all those dancers need costumes and they need makeup and they need security. So backstage, you're looking at 3,000 people all milling about. And then you've got this military operation where you are live on air. And when Lady Gaga's finished her set, you've got 3 minutes to take that down and build a Dell set,
and you've only got one award to do so, and if the person isn't in their seat, Dave Chappelle winning Comedy Album of the Year wasn't there that year, suddenly that 2 minutes that you've built in is actually 5 seconds, but the Adele set's not built, and you're calling it live while you're cutting cameras, while you're talking in Trevor's ear, all the while, you know, trying to make this show happen for 3.5 hours. And whether it be putting together your In Memoriam, which matters more than any other show because of the performances that you're doing, whether it be a tribute to Hip Hop 50, whether it be the great stars who are performing on that night, everything needs to go perfectly. And I look at the Oscars and the Tonys and the Emmys, not the Tonys, I take that back because they're theatre productions, but even them, they're practiced. You know what they're doing. They're going to just do that scene that you've already seen. They're going to just move that into the show. I'm not saying it's not difficult, but it's not from scratch. These are from scratch performances. Ultimately, the Emmys and the Oscars are awards package, read an envelope speech. Awards package, read an envelope speech. We're that as well, plus we're these performances. So the stress of it is like nothing else. And so I did it that first during COVID, and we had some lovely ideas. We got, you know, people who worked in these venues, from the barmaid at the Troubadour to the guy who, you know, owns a bar in Nashville, presenting the Grammys, which was a very beautiful touch. The year after, we had the touring crew, like the production managers, introducing their artists, which I thought was a lovely focus of them. This year we had the fans giving out the award to
Harry in the end. That was your friend.
Absolutely. And so, you know, every year we try and do something different. We try and tell stories. We try and get the, you know, I've always felt like, how do you make some Auntie Margaret in Alabama care about the baby? And you're like, well, you've got to tell that story. You've got to say who he is. You've got to explain it. Maybe that's through a little video piece explaining who it is. Or maybe that's his production manager saying, without this person, I wouldn't be X.
Right.
Maybe DaBaby's a bad example. I should have chosen Billie Eilish. It just came to my mind because we did a tape piece on DaBaby.
Sure.
I've really tried with Raj Kapoor and with Jesse Collins to make the Grammys a real night of entertainment. You can't always win because, you know, everybody has their own Spotify and Apple playlist, right? And there's going to be certain music you just don't like.
Right.
And that's the other thing that I think makes it tough. I know that there will be a genre of music that you don't like, but yet I still need to put it on the show.
Right.
And therefore that you're actively serving somebody something they don't like.
Right.
That's also a difficult task. So I think for all those reasons, it'd be hard-pressed to find a show that's more tricky. Because when you're looking at the Super Bowl, that show's a huge show, much bigger ratings. And I'm not talking about the Super Bowl halftime show that's 12 minutes rather than 3.5 hours. And I don't mean any disrespect to that. The guys who do that are unbelievable. But the Super Bowl itself, the producers of that show are filming something that's already happening. They're not deciding about whether the Rams are going to play well. The Rams are deciding that. Whereas we need to produce the content that we're also filming.
Yeah.
So for that reason, I think it's a difficult show. I'm proud of what we've done with it. I've become much calmer with it. I've had to work on that. I mean, I would be at that first year, I would wake up every morning at like 4, and I've never gone to the gym in my life. I started going for running. I was running at 4:30. My wife, Meredith, was like, what are you doing? I was like, I've got to put Post Malone. How do I get Post Malone? You know, and the COVID era of it made us have to rethink how we did it. Now I'm a bit more relaxed. You know, the people around me have taken more senior roles. You know, Raj has stepped up to run it as well, you know, with us all. And that's really helped because he's amazing. And so, you know, I've got into the run of it now. So I get much less nervous, but there is no feeling than 2 minutes to go before the Grammys goes live, and a pit in your stomach that's like you're walking off the edge of a cliff and you have no idea if the parachute's going
to
open.
I've been lucky enough to be there both before you and since you, and it's really an incredible job you've done. I think it's really it is the most entertaining award show because – partly because of the way you put it together and partly because where else are they really doing, to some degree of the Tonys, like you said, but doing the thing that they're there being honored for. So anyway, it's great. Now, the question that begs, though, is the Oscars something that, if they asked you tomorrow, would you host the Oscars?
Yeah, I'd host it for sure. I would host it, but I'd be worried about some old tweets.
No, if they came and said, would you produce the Oscars? Yes or no? And regardless, as somebody who does this, What do you look at as the biggest challenge of producing the Oscars?
I'm not going to answer what I'd say because I'll wait till they ask.
Okay.
This last year's Oscars was really good. I thought they did a brilliant job, Glenn and Ricky. I thought they were excellent. And so I think that it was as entertaining an Oscars as it's been in a while. I think the Oscars, I feel sorry for the criticism that show gets. And actually, this year it didn't get criticism. But people go on and on about the Oscars. It's not what it used to be. Ugh, it's not what it used to be. And the Billy Crystal singing and the Steve Martin. And those were the good old days of the Oscars. And I'm like, yeah, no shit. They were talking about Titanic and Forrest Gump. Everyone had seen those movies.
Yes.
Don't blame the Oscars. Right. Blame the movie You're industry. Right. Like, I'm not saying that the movies that were nominated this year weren't great, but very few people saw them. More people saw the Oscars than the movies that the Oscars were talking about. How many people saw Everything Everywhere All at Once? How many people saw the Whale?
Yeah.
How many people saw that? Great movies. Yep. I enjoyed them. I saw them. Yep. I'm an AMC member. Yeah. I go every week. I love the movies. But the way the Oscars gets criticism for not being as entertaining as it used to be, without people realizing it, that it's to do with the films that they get given. And the Grammys, by the way, is similar. If you get a load of artists nominated that no one likes or no one enjoys, then it's going to be harder to produce a show. It's easy to produce a show when you've got Bad Bunny and Harry Styles and you've got Adele and you've got Beyonce and you've got Taylor and you've got these. It's great artists. It's down to the nominations, and that's down to our industry. And our industry has changed so much that I'm not, by the way, I really want to make it clear, I'm not denigrating these amazing movies.
No.
I'm just saying a fact. That is, people aren't watching movies like they used to. And so therefore, Top Gun hugely helped this year. That was a big, big movie. I think Elvis's film, the Elvis film and Austin Butler's performance really helped this year.
Maybe
it
Avatar.
Got people, Avatar. It got people excited again. And maybe next year, if they start looking at, you know, Barbie and Oppenheimer and Mission Impossible and those sorts of films that are brilliant, then the Oscars won't get as much criticism. But I think it's really hard to criticize the Oscars as a show and criticize the producers of that show when you're working with the Birdman rather than Forrest Gump. Did I get the name of the Birdman right?
Yeah, Birdman.
But my mom and dad never saw it.
No, a lot of people didn't. But here's one other big difference, I guess, between the Tonys, the Grammys, and the Emmys compared to the Oscars. All of them present their quote-unquote minor categories on some sort of a pre-show. There's the Creative Arts Emmys.
Yeah.
There's the pre-show of both the Grammys and the Tonys. The Oscars, all 23 awards are going to be on that telecast, because when they've tried to take them off, there's been an uproar, and it doesn't look like that's an option of somehow shifting that around. So I guess as a producer, I know you're not going to say whether or not you would take on the job, but if you had the job, is there any way to overcome the fact that the general public, first of all, you've said they haven't seen most of the movies, but even if they have, there's probably about 6 awards there that they actually care about of the 23. What do you do about that?
Well, they tried to do something and there was an uproar. Mm-hmm. So at some point you sort of, you know, you've got to make the best of what you have. I think a television producer is always going to feel different to an Academy member. Mm-hmm. I think that's your job as a television producer. I think all I can say is that all I can talk of is my experience. And my experience is I partner with Harvey Mason Jr. at the Recording Academy. And a better guy you just couldn't meet. And Harvey and I talk really openly. We talk really honestly. We have a push and pull. He'll come at it saying, this is what we really need. I'll say, yeah, but this is what I really need. And there is a huge respect and love there between us. And it makes a really great show. I can't speak to what the Academy, because I haven't done it. What I mean? So it's a really tricky thing for me to say. I do think that you can't say, the amount of time I hear people say, oh, the Oscars, it's too long. But at the same time, how dare you take out those awards?
Yes.
It's like, well, hold on, which do you want? you can't have it all. I think with everything in life, there's always sacrifices that you have to make. And the producer just needs to make sure that they make that correct sacrifice. I think, like I said, this last year that I saw, I felt like they did it really, really well. It felt pacey. I really enjoyed it. I actually went. I was a guest there this year and I enjoyed it. It was the first time I'd been to the Oscars and I was really honored to go. And I thought they did a very good job. But then I also think, you know, and they'd be the first to say this, they got lucky because the speeches were great.
Yeah.
And you're reliant on great speeches and great moments. And if you don't get that, it's not the producer's fault. You know, Anthony Hopkins may have given the greatest speech of all time if he was there at the Oscars the year he won, but
right.
He wasn't there, right. So they got unlucky. You know, it's like it is tough.
Not to mention if somebody slaps the shit out of somebody.
It's tough
to produce these shows. Right. It really is. And that's why you'd be insane to do it. And that's why sometimes I'm like, what am I doing? I could so have an easier life. But there's something about the Grammys and the music of it and my love for music and the honor that it is to produce it that makes me really want to do it. And I love the people I make the show with. And I know that's a corny thing to say, but from like all the way through that team, you know, Patrick Menton and Raj, and I just love working with that team and it makes me happy. And actually, we're in the trenches together, so it's more fun.
Connecting the dots finally to 2023.
I'm really enjoying this, but do you think anyone's still listening?
Absolutely.
I think there is.
I hope you're not feeling like I'm taking too much of your time.
No, I could beer all night. We're talking about me. I'm delighted. No, I just think that I reckon we lost most listeners when they realized
it's just about to get good. Here we go.
It wasn't Brad Pitt. And they were like, oh, I'll skip it. I'll wait till the strike's over and then I'll come back to this podcast.
Okay. So I know that you have had all kinds of interesting challenges as a producer. We can talk about the fact that with Adele, you won an Emmy for Adele One Night Only. That was supposed to happen the night after it actually happened. You had to change everything, including the audience, everything, right, to happen a day early. Friends reunion. You are the person who finally got convinced these six people to be in a room together for the first time, I think, in 17.
I got convinced. You mean I convinced them?
Well, you convinced them to do the job, but then they hadn't been in a – people have been trying to get this type of a thing forever, right? So those are just some of the – now the Kardashians, you know, after 20 years on E – I guess decide they want to go to Hulu, go elsewhere, do it a little different, elevate it. You get the job of doing that. And I think these kind of connect because I've heard that maybe it was the Friends thing that impressed them. Anyway, these are the kinds of challenges that you have taken on that lead us to the two things that really were 2023 the things that you're for which you're nominated going into the Emmys. We've talked a lot about Carpool Karaoke, if you'd like to add anything about that. But the other one, which I was also very lucky to be in attendance for while you were working hard, I'm sitting there, was the last U.S. concert of Sir Elton John given at Dodger Stadium on the night of Sunday, November 20th. This is as a television program. It went out live on Disney Plus. It's categorized, listed on the ballot as Elton John Live Farewell from Dodger Stadium. I know you've done stuff with Disney before. I know you're a British guy who grew up, you know, like all of us with Elton John. But how do you wind up with the task of chronicling almost 50 years after his famous first Dodger Stadium concert, this farewell?
My partner Gabe Turner was sniffing around it and he called me and he was like, I think I've heard that Elton's last gig is going to be on Disney Plus. And I don't know if that's true, but I've heard it. And Gabe's info and intel is usually fantastic. and if you met Gabe, you'd absolutely love him because, you know, he's someone who just talent adores. And actually, because although we're partners, we very rarely get to work together. And actually, we both love Elton. And we sort of looked at this at each other and thought this could be quite, like, our mums would be proud of this one. Our mums would really love us doing this one. So we did it together. We got a call from Disney and they said, look, it was 12 weeks before the show, maybe 10 weeks before the show. And they said, we've just done a deal with Elton John. We're going to do a documentary with him, which we're not, mate. You know, that was already in the works. But we're going to do Dodger Stadium live on Disney. And it was significant, I think, for three reasons. Well, aside from those three reasons, he's Elton John.
Right.
And I was like, my head exploded. Right. I was like, this could be so cool to work with Elton John. What an icon, what a legend. The first reason I thought this is massive is going back to Dodger Stadium, where it's the most iconic photo. If you think of Elton John, you're thinking of him 1975 in Dodger Stadium, the sequin outfit, this massive audience. There was a British guy standing in front of an American Los Angeles audience who so loved him. And those Terry O'Neill photographs that are so iconic. And if for me, thinking about an Elton John moment, just the fact he was revisiting Dodgers and being the people that could film that moment made me incredibly excited. The second reason that made me excited was I'm a TV geek. I love making TV. I love all of this stuff that we're talking about. And it was going to be the first ever live Disney Plus show
globally. So you're making a show that is on the most iconic platform, and it's the first, and it's live, and it's going to be me, Gabe, and Sally Wood making it. And you're like, this is insane. And then the third reason, which is the most significant, was it was his farewell. This is the last time an audience was really going to see him on tour in America. And the fact that we were going to broadcast it live was incredibly exciting. Then your head goes to all the issues and the problems. You've got, a huge venue. How do you record sound in a venue like that? Because if your ears go into that venue, you hear 100,000 people. But you put a microphone in there, you're only hearing the 7 or 8 people around it. And you can put as many microphones in as you want it, but there's no roof. It's hugely wide. I mean, I'm going into the details.
No, I love this. This is where great. Your head goes. Please.
You're then going, how do you both film the intimacy of that gig, that love letter between a fan of 5 years old in the front row who's wearing a sequined outfit and a 90-year-old woman who's been to every show that Elton's ever done. And this is the last time they're going to see him in front of them. For some, it's the first. For some, it's the last. But either for all of us, it was the last.
Yep.
And you've got to create that intimacy and tell those stories. But yet at the same time, you've got to show off this ginormous scale of 100,000 people at Dodger Stadium. You've also got the issue of live and going, well, like, is it going to sound good enough? Are we going to light it well enough? Are we going to, how do we shoot it well enough? Paul Dugdale directed it, who worked with me on the Adele special, and I think is a real genius. And we all worked together to create a show that was really magical. And that night was one of the highlights of my career, really. I've never felt as elated as that after a show, because we actually did a dress run on the Saturday night, the night before.
I was going to ask you, because so they did Friday night, which I also went to. Saturday I didn't, and then Sunday, right?
It was slightly different. Yes.
Thursday.
Thursday, Saturday, Sunday.
Okay, right.
Yeah.
So now my question, what I'm wondering, even knowing that Sunday was going to be filmed, I was trying to see, are you guys, aside from just scouting out how it's going to look and where you have to have your cameras and whatever, were you actually filming stuff? What if the Disney live feed goes out?
Yeah, great question. So the first night was the Thursday night, and we didn't have a single camera on him. Because we couldn't also afford the trucks for that long. We had 28 cameras, 2 drones and a helicopter. So we didn't have any of that on Thursday.
You said 23 cameras?
28.
28.
I think it was 28. Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
That's incredible. No, that's amazing.
23 to 28.
With the drones.
Maybe 28 including the drones and the heli.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Maybe it was 25 crewed, but that's, 2 drones.
For people's reference, that is not, that doesn't happen.
True, but also you don't really film at Dodger Stadium often.
Right.
So like you've also got to remember there's so many angles there. It's so massive, it's so wide. You're not in an arena or a small stadium. You're in the round. So you really had to capture what was happening. And so we went for it. And so the Thursday night I went and I just sat with my wife as an audience member. On the Thursday night I sat in the middle of the bowl. I sat row 30,
yeah.
Didn't want a great seat, wasn't in the front, wasn't at the back. I on purpose just wanted a decent seat.
Right.
And I experienced it. And I did that on purpose because I think I'm an EP that will always be in the truck. I'm always in the control.
You'll
never ever see me out on the floor. I don't believe in being out on the floor ever. It's an American English thing, I think. Americans like feeling it, being in the room, in the magic. And I'm like, no. I want to see every single camera. I want to hear what the audience hear. I want to be able to talk to my lighting guy calmly. I want to be able to talk to the audio team. I want to speak to a writer. I want to control that auto cue, that prompter. I want to be able to talk to the director. And I also want to speak in the talent's ear and talk calmly. I can control everything from one seat. Being out there doesn't, I'll never do it. Grammys, all of that. I've changed it. Like Grammys used to be, the producer's table.
Right.
That is not there. It's about being really in trust for me. Always has been. And so where was I? Elton. That's right.
Yeah.
Sorry. I got sidetracked.
Who you had gotten to know in the lead up to the show?
No, not particularly really. I think Elton, I got to know David Furnish really well. I think David, of course they have an amazing relationship, but they also have a great work relationship in that Elton just trusts David hugely. So I met Elton. He was lovely, but he trusts David and David and me and Duggars and Gabe. We all worked on it. So first night I just sat there and I watched the show and we took it all in. We all did. We all just took it all in and we noticed things. We're like, oh, that could be interesting. And we learned a lot about the show. Saturday night we filmed it and we filmed it for 2 reasons. We filmed it as a dress rehearsal so we could learn from it. And you're right. We filmed it in case the cameras went out or there was a power cut or anything else. Then at least we had a copy of it that we could play out that night. we finished on Saturday night and we all watched it back in this porter cabin in the parking lot of Dodger Stadium at midnight. We watched it from midnight till like 2:33 in the morning. And I can't remember ever feeling as low.
Oh, really?
It was terrible. Elton wasn't.
Yeah,
he was brilliant.
Sure.
But the cameras weren't getting it. We were cutting late. We missed the fireworks. It sounded like five people were in the stadium. It was dreadful. And it was a really, it was a huge wake up call on that show. And we sort of all went to bed quite nervous. And we'd been excited all the way through. We'd been like, we're filming Elton. It's the farewell gig. This is great. The only thing we were worried about is the technology. Will it be all right? You know, will the feed be okay? And that was all I was ever worried about. And we literally like spent all night. Doug has reworked a lot, spent time speaking to the cameramen. I went in, chatted with Mike Abbott for hours, and we came up with a really good plan of how to mic it. And I love getting in the weeds on things. Mm-hmm. I love sitting with someone like Mike.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's been doing this for a long time. I don't think he'd mind saying he's a little bit older than me. And we'll sit there together and we'll like bottom it out until we work out a solution. And we went through each problem and we solved it. And we worked right up until, you know, 6, 7 p.m. the following night. We felt going into that show that we were really confident that we'd ironed out camera positions that were wrong, cameras that got in each other's way, the timing of when we had to cut wide. We were like, going badly for us on the Saturday night was the best thing that could have ever happened to that show, because everybody was on fire the following night. Elton's vocals never changed. They were unbelievable. Right. It was one of my big worries. If I'm going to be honest with you, I was thinking, here's a guy who's an older guy now, and I've worked in music television for a long time. Everybody needs an audio pass. I can promise you. Not that many people sound good actually live, and partly because they can't hear themselves.
Right.
Like, it's not because they're not great if they're in a quiet audio booth. It's not because their voice isn't good. It's because of the circumstances they're singing in. Elton's voice was flawless, and what you heard on that special is exactly what it sounded like. We did no work on that voice.
Wow.
And the one thing I thought was crazy was when I turned to David Furnish and I was like, how are you feeling? This is a month before. How are you feeling about, you know, Elton's vocals? Are we going to feed in a bit of track? Are we going to have a, you know, are we going to support it in any way? And he went, no, we won't need to. He's never sounded better. And I remember thinking, oh, love is blind.
Yeah.
And I was entirely wrong and he was entirely right. Elton's never sounded better and he was amazing. But that night was magical, and it just couldn't have gone better. And it became a real sort of highlight of all of our careers, really, in making that. And I think Elton's really proud of it.
Well, I heard him say it because you guys did this beautiful screening of it after the fact at the Academy. And clearly he and David were thrilled. It plays beautifully. Obviously, I didn't see it live because I was there. But to get to see it later was very special.
My wife said something really nice. And I don't think she's being biased because she is very honest. She went on the Thursday night with me. Mm-hmm. And we sat there and watched it. And then she sat and watched it on the Sunday. And she enjoyed the experience so much more on the Sunday. She said that it just felt exciting and alive. And she enjoyed the experience of watching it at home so much more than being there, which is really saying something.
Yeah.
People want to be in the room where it happens.
Sure.
And I sort of know what she means. It's a really, if anyone hasn't seen it, I do recommend it on Disney Plus. But it's also, listen, the app, I'm not, you know, I don't know if I'm allowed to even say this, but of course, the cherry on the cake with this sort of project would be the fact that this could be the thing that wins Elton an EGOT.
Right, exactly.
And considering he's been Gabe and my hero since we were kids, the idea that the show that we made wins him an Emmy when he's got the other three would be the ultimate gift to
your Adele special won the same, or was it, that was pre-recorded.
That was pre-recorded.
And this is live.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. We've got some tough competition, but let's not talk about that.
Yeah,
let's let's just hope that everyone ignores all the other nominations and just does a favor for Elton John.
Last minute here, and thank you so much for all your time. This is just sort of the rapid fire, just the first thing or two that come to mind. Number one, who from, as far as carpool karaoke, is the one who got away?
Beyonce.
Okay.
Nearly happened. They confirmed once, and then the dates didn't. Then there was something, I can't even remember it all, but it wasn't far off.
I think if we'd been on another year or two, you never know.
Interesting. You're a handsome man. You work in television. You see how it's done. Why are you not in front of the camera?
Oh, I wouldn't enjoy it.
No?
No. I'm so happy with what I do. I really love I think on-screen talent has such a hard thing to cope with being judged at every stage. And I think I've really felt over the years as I've got you know, I'm 41, but as I've got older, I felt luckier and luckier in that I get to do this incredibly creative job and work with the most creative people and miss out on that one bit that they all have to deal with. And I'm really, I've got a really happy life. And I also don't think I'd be good enough. Like, I don't. I think that, you know, you're very kind, but you might need more than a nice face. And I work with people like James, and I work with people like Trevor, and then I work with people like Adele or Harry or comedians or actors. And you're like, no. Like, they are unbelievable talent that I don't have. And I think I'm really good at what I do.
Absolutely.
And I think they're really good at what they do.
Yeah.
And that partnership is what leads to these shows that we've been talking about today.
Totally. Number three, The Late Late Show is not going to be replaced by another late night variety style talk show. Does that decision by CBS make sense to you?
Yes. I don't think the economics work. I just don't think the economics work for a broadcast network today. I think we were the last hurrah of being able to get a budget that would be able to fulfill our fantasies of being able to blow things up and sing in a car. And, you know, carpool's not cheap. You know, there's a lot of music license rights and performing in a crosswalk. I think that the business has changed so much that people are not waiting up till 12:30 to watch a show at all.
Mm-hmm.
And if your business model is fundamentally reliant on commercials, then it's a very, very difficult thing to launch. Now, we got lucky because brands wanted to be involved with us. So the majority of our money as a show came from spin-offs like Carpool and Drop the Mic, came from the sponsor at the bar, came from product placement, you know, Selena Gomez.
Going to McDonald's.
Going to McDonald's. These things were very, very lucrative moments for our show. Very lucrative.
Right.
If you were to start a brand new late night show, there is nothing to say that you would get any of those today at a 12:30 show. We got lucky. We had a digital hit, which allowed it.
Right.
So you've either got to go massive and spend millions and get a megastar who will get the brand integrations before they've even started, or you've got to go really cheap and hope that somebody's massive again like James and can get that brand integration. But for CBS spending what they want to spend, I think to bet the house on one person won't happen again. And I think, as I'll finish as I started, I think there aren't many performers like James Corden.
Right.
And I think that James didn't have Saturday Night Live as a CV or as a resume. He didn't have The Daily Show. He wasn't known to American public for years. He was a cheap host when he came on. He was a cheap date for CBS. And he blew up and he showed them what they could do. And I don't think two James Cordens come along. And so therefore, I think that those days of that are probably gone on network television at that time slot. Can new hosts come into primetime and do well? Absolutely. Can late night hosts do well on streaming? Absolutely. But if you're talking about CBS at 12:30, I think this show that they haven't even announced yet, but I think is, you know, a remake of At Midnight, it's going to do great. It's going to do great because you've got to keep Colbert's audience. That's the trick. And therefore, if you can have a show exec produced by Stephen about the news that will be catered to his audience, you've got a real chance.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think they've made a mistake.
Last one. I mentioned the Oscars. To me, that would be an exciting next step for you. I don't know if you feel excited about it. But what is, you know, to you, if we could look inside your mind, what's on the bucket list still?
I've got something that we're going to announce in a few weeks' time that I'm really excited by. And I'd be disingenuous to sort of not say that because I've been thinking about it a really long time and I really want to do it. And so, you know, we'll text each other in a month and you'll go, oh yeah, that's pretty cool. I think for me, I feel so lucky. I feel so lucky. And actually, it's really nice to sit here and chat with you because life gets so busy. You know, my day started today at 7:30 was my first Zoom. And I was on calls or emails or texts or edit suites up until I walked in here today at 5:00 in the afternoon. And actually, just to stop and reflect has been really lovely because you get to think back on like why you love doing what you do. So it's not about specific bucket list things. It's just continuing to make shows with people I love, with teams that I really love, with talent that I'm impressed by, that like wow me. Because, you know, when you're at a Grammys rehearsal and you hear Adele sing, there's nothing like it. When you're on the floor of the Late Late Show and you see James, you know, do a sketch, there's nothing like it. And it's those moments that, you know, make me so excited to carry on going. So it's just working with great talent, with great teams, making shows that people really love, whether it be your Elton specials or your Kardashians, your late night shows. I'm very lucky to work on shows that people love and enjoy, and I hope that long continues and I don't get found out too quickly.
You've been great. Thank you so much.
I appreciate it. Really enjoyed it. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate it and would really appreciate you taking just a minute more to subscribe to the podcast and to leave us a rating and review on your podcast app. And to follow us on Twitter and Instagram, where our handle is @AwardsChatter. On those platforms, we announce upcoming guests and provide details about special live recordings of the podcast that you can attend. Until next time, thanks again for tuning in.